You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's episode, journalist and author Paola Harris joins me to discuss an intriguing UFO case that predates the Roswell incident by a good 2 years. In her new book, co-authored with the legendary Jacques Vallée, Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, looks into the reports that something crashed in the White Sands area, just after the US had tested some of its atomic capabilities. First-hand witnesses, official cover-ups, strange premonitions, alien beings, and retrieved wreckage all point to the Trinity case being extremely intriguing. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel under @MysteriesMonsters. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Artwork, as always, by the marvellous Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. The atomic age had just begun, but did it create ripples beyond our planet that summer of 1945 that encouraged others to come pay us a visit? On today's episode, we find ourselves returning to the end of World War II and a period of incredible change being undertaken beneath the curtain of secrecy and the testing of a weapon that changed the history of the world. I'm delighted to welcome investigative journalist and author Paola Harris to the show. With a long and deep interest into the unidentified aerial phenomenon, Paola has investigated some of the most perplexing cases from around the world. In the new updated version of Trinity, co-written with Jacques Vallée, we look at a case that has left to gather dust since a few days in August 1945 that changed the perception of everything. Paola, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for asking me. It's a pleasure to talk to you across the pond.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to finally get a chance to speak with you. As I was joking and pulling your leg before we started the interview proper, you're someone I've been aware of for a very long time, as I always like to keep an eye out for anybody that deals with this whole UAP, UFO, aerial phenomenon perception, and able to deal with cases outside of the normal scope of things. And obviously you've done a lot of work based in Central and South America, and obviously some of the publications that you've released in Italian and Europe as well.
Yeah, the thing is that I am an investigative journalist. I want to say that first. I'm not a ufologist, so I'm not part of all that group. I'm just curious, and I do it because I want to know. And as I was telling you before, all of my life is synchronistic. I mean, I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1979. I went to Evanston, Illinois, because I wanted to ask Dr. J. Allen Hynek, you know, who's Blue Book scientist, if it was real, you know. And so I didn't expect him to be there when I walked into the Center for UFO Studies. And there he was with his pipe. And he said to me, "Do you want to work with me?" Well, of course. I'm Italian. I was born in Italy. And so I was with him and did his Italian translations. And then he'd come down to Colorado and I would drive him around. I became friends with the family. Today, I'm very close to Paul Hynek, who's on a lot of conferences and so forth, because he was a little kid when I started working with his dad. Mm-hmm. But when his dad died in 1986, Paul, I just didn't want to do any more. I was devastated. But I moved to Italy to teach in a private school in 1992, and they knew I had worked with Hynek. And of course, when you work with Hynek, you know, it's real. He's a scientist. Mm. Little did I ever dream that I would meet Jacques Vallée, who is in the movie Close Encounters, you know, who was represented in that movie, and that I would kind of end my career with Jacques Vallée. I start with Hynek, I end with Vallée. So it's too weird for me.
But what was it that you got bitten by the bug, Paolo? Because obviously, so for some people, it's certain cases, or they live in certain areas in the US or over here in the UK, or they, for us here, a lot of people got into UFOs because of Rendlesham or Alan Godfrey or anything like that. So for you, what was it that drew you to the subject in those early days that you ended up, you fortuitously bumping into Mr. Hynek?
Well, the thing is, when I saw the film, the last scene when Francois Truffaut plays Lacombe, has the interaction with the being, I started to cry. And I never dealt with UFOs. I was 32 years old back then, so you can figure out the math, how old I am now. But the thing is that I just really couldn't. It was so emotional, the contact. But then when I began working with Hynek, it was nuts and bolts. I mean, all I was doing was putting pins in maps and reporting to him nuts and bolts stuff. It wasn't until I went to Latin America that I had to digest the fact that there are beings inside these craft. And then I had to deal with that. And when I met John Mack, when he came to Italy to visit me, that's when I had to start saying, okay, you're fine with all the data, but you better get a clue as to what's really happening here, because then you have to go into the reasons why the beings, the interdimensionality, the time travel, all that stuff that for me was very hard to swallow. It's not easy because they are concepts that I was not born with, that nobody taught me, and that are very unpopular. That's why there's so much ridicule around this. So it took a long time, long time for me to graduate into the graduate school of studying this phenomenon, which I still call UFOs, okay? I mean, you can change it anyway, or
yeah,
but and make it like the in thing, or the mode, or the latest flavor of ice cream, I always say, but it is unidentified flying objects. And some of them over the years have become identified.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating. So I don't understand why everybody doesn't look into this.
It is perplexing. I think, as I've said to other people involved in this particular subject, Paolo, over the years, for me, as someone that's had a real interest in this subject for the best part of 40 years, I can't remember a period of time that it seems to be taken as seriously as it is, even though there's always still going to be ridicule out there from certain sections, regardless. Let's not pretend that that doesn't go on anymore. It seems that it finally seems to be, as you've mentioned about the work you did with Hynek and others throughout your career, and obviously the scientific knowledge and experience that Jacques brings to the subject, that for a lot of people, it's finally seemed to have matured a little bit, that we've got to a point where we can seemingly have a proper conversation about this subject without the cliches being rolled out from certain naysayers, shall we say.
You're very right, Paul. The thing, and my own kids said, Mom, it was in the New York Times, so you must be telling the truth. Yeah, right. So you're waiting for the New York Times to see that I didn't waste my life, you know? So it's okay now, but that's not the real deal. I think, and I'm going to mention Timothy Good, people like Timothy Good and me and Jacques and Alan and so forth that are boots on the ground researchers. Like, I didn't do anything. I didn't personally go there and talk to the person. I don't do stuff on the phone or on the internet and so forth. For us, if you study it and start to connect a few dots, you can see what the picture is. And I really love Trinity. And I can start talking about this because Trinity shows it in the framework of a geopolitical situation of history. This is the latest cover of Trinity because we found a fourth witness, so I am going to show it to you. This is the revised version. It says that for people. And when I was in Italy, I read about these two little boys that had seen a controlled craft come in 1945. I read about it and thought, why are my colleagues going out there? They're alive. They know the people are alive. They know exactly where it crashed. And if you read the story, the nine-year-old went in there and pulled a piece off the wall. So we even have metal. It has three things that no other case has. But the thing that interested me the most was that it happened 1 month after the atomic bomb exploded in the Trinity site, the White Sands site. And it is exactly, and we've been there now almost 9 years, it is exactly 13 miles away from that point. So whatever was flying around there was not on vacation. And whatever is flying around Maelstrom Air Force Base is not on vacation. And whatever is flying around Ukraine right now has decided to put some attention there. So I think what everybody's missing is, number one, the collaboration. And I'm so excited to work with someone like Jacques Vallée. I mean, he's very nuts and bolts science, but I, you know, the collaboration of male and female and our views, and it's great. And then the fact that I wish everybody would look at this in a geopolitical framework and get a timeline and realize that even the book Trinity isn't a UFO book. It's a history book. This is the history of planet Earth. These are things that happen. Maelstrom in 1969 happened. You know, the flyover of Washington in 1952 happened. I don't know where you're going to argue with that. There is no, those are data. That's data. It's not a matter of belief. You know, people say, do you believe it? It's not a religion. It's an accumulation of data that unfortunately doesn't fit into any framework. And because I have a master's in education, I wish it would. I wish there would be a university course on this. And I wish we would look at it as we do anthropology, psychology, and geology, because we have enough data to connect a few dots if they look at it on a timeline.
I mean, I'm surprised, even as someone that studied the Second World War at college, Paola, I have to say, I'm still surprised when I discover things that went on during the end of the Second World War, and especially with Project Manhattan, with it being based out there, and what was going on with Oppenheimer when they were working with his team of international scientists ferreting away all around the US till they pulled them all to New Mexico to begin to work on the project properly. So when I was reading those opening chapters of the book, when they were talking about what happened with the Manhattan Project, I find it remarkable that the US government thought that, as Jacques has said, it wasn't a test. They dropped a bomb.
They dropped a bomb. Yeah, you know, they did.
I'm not really sure what the difference is.
First of all, I learned a lot. They it was on the ground that they exploded it. So they realized that if it was in the air, it would probably do less damage. And, you know, and they did drop it on Nagasaki and Hiroshima from the air. Did more damage on the ground, and they didn't tell the people. And the radiation's 150 square miles radius. And that's part of the story, you know, because poor Jose lost his hearing. His eardrum ruptured, and his mother was blinded in one eye at 4:30 in the morning. I mean, these are the witnesses that everybody says, oh, they're only children, don't listen to them. Come on. This story, because it is children, and because they waited 60 years, and everybody said, oh, they waited 60 years. Well, he took something that didn't belong to him from inside the craft. You're not going to brag about it. You're not going to come out and say, I stole a piece from the inside of a UFO. And I hate to use the word stole. He said he borrowed it because he ended up giving it to me. I put it in a safe deposit box for 2 years until Jacques approached me 4 years ago because I had metal. I mean, he's nuts and bolts, so he wants metal. So he heard about this and he goes, you got it. And I said, it's in the safe deposit box. And that's when he began working with me because he was fascinated with the entire case. And we would go down to Socorro 3 times a year to talk to Jose, go on location and so forth. So if somebody said, have you analyzed it? Yes, I was doing it 5 years. Jacques never met Remy, the 6-7-year-old. He never met him. And I made sure I got him on film and worked with him and got all the details. And Remy and Jose never lived close to each other. They separated when they were like, 11 or 12 years old. But Remy went to Washington State and Jose went to California. So when they reached, you know, could find each other through a genealogical thing that Jose's son found them, it was 60 years later. So, you know, the first words were, do you remember what happened? They go, yeah, do you remember what happened? What happened to the piece? I mean, it went like that. It isn't like, oh, let's go and tell the world what we did and all that. You know, people don't understand. this story is amazing. And it's before Roswell. It's before Kenneth Arnold coined the term flying saucer. They didn't know what the world they were looking at. They didn't know anything about aliens. Neither did the government, I think, because the boys that cleaned up that crash were from the Manhattan Project. And Jose was telling me one of the young boys even married his cousin. So they all knew each other. So it was more that you go down there. They all know each other. Everybody's a relative of everybody. And the story is outrageous.
Mm. Do you think, Paula, I mean, I'd heard of it briefly before the book came out. So I was aware of it. I know it's mentioned in the book, and you've mentioned Timothy Good earlier as well.
Yes, he's amazing.
It's one of those cases that both yourself and Jack mentioned throughout the book, that you scratch your head and you think, well, why have people left this alone for so long? And it happens sometimes, especially when we're talking about ufology. For some reason, Paula, certain cases just don't seem to gain any traction. And people, as you touched on there, everybody talks about Roswell being the beginning and Kenneth Arnold, that's when UFOs started, which if you look backwards throughout history, you'll know that that's palpable nonsense. It's the modern era that the media started taking attention, really. It's not that UFOs just suddenly turned up and Kenneth Arnold saw them, because clearly things were happening prior to that. Trinity is one of those cases where we've had a monumental history-defining moment occur in the White Sands testing range that changes human history from the moment that bomb goes off. That's it. The world is never going to be the same again, whatever happens. So are you perplexed that people seem to have just completely left this alone for so long?
Well, you're asking me a personal question, which I'm going to make a statement about. I'm not really enchanted with my field, because the reasoning behind a lot of the research is like my field is, you know, either attention or the selling of books or something. They don't want to just know. And the thing is that since I grew up with Hynek and now Valet, the conversations we have about ufology have nothing to do with our personal presence or notoriety or anything. We all just want to know. Yeah. And they're not going to jump on something that, in fact, we gave all the book to all the greatest researchers and they didn't even bother to read it. So you think, and I knew those people, I brought them over to Italy to speak and we gave the book over to them and they never even made comments on it. So how do you think I feel? I thought we were colleagues and they could take some of the stuff from the book and put it together. I believe in research, getting together around a table and putting the pieces together. Mm. In our field, we do not do that. It's like people take ownership of the story and that's it. And it's money making or whatever. And I have only found certain people like people from universities or in the case, because we talk about the Atomic Energy Commission, some of those scientists got hold of us. And those kinds of people were like mind blown about this story. Our own ufologists, I mean, we had some problems with people coming after us. Hmm. And they did not support. If you name anybody in the field, they have not supported us or the book, their story. But I love speaking to an atomic energy scientist who talked about Dixie Lee being the governor of Washington State, because that's where Remy ended up. And because he was Hispanic, he helped get her elected, because he got her elected. So she calls him into the office and she says, okay, thank you very much. I'm going to let you see your file. Opens up the file in the Atomic Energy Commission. It's not in the Air Force, so don't go looking for it, because there was no Air Force then. Army Air Force was together. It's not in Blue Book. Blue Book didn't start then. So, you know, she opens up the file and she says, thank you very much. Here's the and nobody will ever see it because the Atomic Energy Commission files are the biggest top secret ever. Yeah. And not even the president can look at them. So people will say, oh, yeah, where's the book? I mean, people don't do their homework. They don't even know the Army Air Force broke off. So it was the Army Air Force together, and they had never seen anything like this in 45, 1 month after the atomic bomb. So they don't know it's a UFO. It's avocado shaped with a little dome on. They don't know what it is. And they don't have anybody with hazmat suits. So they're getting the same guys that we're on the Manhattan Project and they've got, you imagine, their Jeep and they're playing Western music. They don't even know what they got. Yeah. And the boys, when they went up to it, had no frame of reference. They thought it was a plane that came down. They thought the little omozitos that were sashaying back and forth were children. Mm-hmm. They didn't know they don't know what aliens. I mean, there's nothing there. And you know what's so amazing, Paul, is that these beings communicated telepathically with Remy, who was 7, and Jose, who was 9. And Remy got a vision of people falling out of a skyscraper. Mm-hmm. And he told me about that. He said, of course, he never saw a skyscraper. I mean, he's in New Mexico. It's all flat desert. And so then I have to think. Okay, if I didn't happen on this story, if the son of the pilot hadn't called me and given me the names and addresses and telephone numbers of the two kids, what would have happened to this story? Mm-hmm. And then I thought, whoa, what happened to this story is that those beings knew Jack and I were going to write a book about it. They knew we were going to make a statement about nuclear. They knew that Jack was going to say that the emperor of Japan had capitulated before we even threw those two bombs. And we did the two bombs as a test, but he had already surrendered, so you can't use that excuse. So this book is more history, Paul, than it is ufology.
Yeah. I'm often surprised, Paula, that most people don't realize that when the atomic bomb program was started, that was going to be designed to be dropped in Europe. It was going to be dropped in Germany.
Oh my God.
And I think a lot of people just presume for some reason that the Manhattan Project was working on Japan, and it wasn't. Japan only ended up getting hit because they hadn't surrendered.
Well, they had surrendered. That's the problem. When you read this book, they had already surrendered. Because Jacques is a historian, so Jacques read like all the books. The Japanese have the rights to our book right now, so I'd like to see what they say now. I'm going, Jack, are you sure you should have done this? But he basically, I know. The only time I've seen him become emotional and cry is almost when he describes the fact that the emperor did surrender, told his officers that it was over, and they went to their offices to commit Harry Caray. And that was before we dropped it. So I think they needed to know if it was going to work. They needed, in other words, what happened in White Sands, what wasn't a test, it was a real bomb, but it didn't affect anything the way that a bomb should affect something. It did affect in that all the people didn't know about it, and the cattle and the leukemia and everything like that happened after that. It was very bad. And I think there is a court case against the government for not letting them know. But how could they let them know? It was top secret. And Oppenheimer, who then had his security clearance taken away and everything, I think he was very emotional about what had happened, because if you see the actual plaque near when you go into White Sands there into Trinity, it says the beginning of the atomic age. I am death, the killer of worlds, plural. I think that's really from the Bhagavad Gita. And so I'm going, okay, so if this is death, the killer of worlds, the other worlds, the parallel worlds, the dimensional worlds, the interplanetary worlds, were given a sign that this was going to affect them also. So the fact that we have all of these, you know, incidences in New Mexico is a consequence of we got somebody's attention. Somebody's.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many tantalizing parts to this initial discovery by Remy and Jose. As you've referred to there, Paolo, when you're talking about the psychic images that they were receiving, there's a lot of this story that doesn't really tally, as people will say, and as you've mentioned earlier, that why did they sit on it for 60 years, especially during the 90s, where ufology had a massive explosion in popularity, especially in the US. It was everywhere. Every show and cable network was running shows on UFOs and cases. And obviously Roswell was front and center for a lot of people throughout that. It would have been very easy for Remy or Jose to come forward and say, well, here's my story. I want a part of this. But they didn't, even in the light of it.
They did. Jose couldn't, because he's the one that took the piece. You know, he's not going to do that. But Remy went to Stanton Friedman. And Stanton said he put it in his grade files. See, these people, they don't go to the place. They don't see it. And he went to, I think, to some of the Roswell, who didn't want another case because Roswell is Mecca.
Yeah.
Remy did go to some people, and there's been criticism on that. He did. They didn't listen to him. So he let it go until, you know, I told you my life is weird. I end up at the weirdest places, and I didn't think I'd be doing this case. I was hoping everybody else would get on it. And, you know, and then I got the call from the son of the pilot that overflew. And then I said, I'm jumping on this. I didn't care if it was going to become popular. This for me really happened. We have enough data. This really happened. I am a history teacher. I have a master's in education. You got to know the facts. What are we going to hide a piece of the planet Earth, the history? This is a history of planet Earth. It is not a UFO story. And when the two boys had this interaction with the beings and the craft, it was the first time nobody knew what to do. So, and they said, where do they take it? Well, of course, Alamogordo. And of course, it's in the atomic energy. And of course, that doesn't mean anything as far as proving it's real. When I was working with these two guys, they lived in different states. And after 60 years, they had the exact same story. And they had artifacts. And then I'm talking after I meet Jacques and we're sitting on a porch with Jose and he's going, well, my 7-year-old niece was in the house and she played with the angel hair and trimmed the Christmas tree. I said, what? can she talk about this? And Jose, yeah, I forgot to tell you, she was in the house. I was out of the house by then. So of course we're going to fly to Los Angeles where Sabrina lives. And of course, Jacques and I and another high profile person were there questioning her. But there came a call to Sabrina. It said, Paula Harris will not come. We will take care of this. And so Sabrina called me and she said, are you still coming? I said, of course. And she's in the book. And here is this little girl who doesn't know about a crash, but she was told not to go to that area. And she went and she saw all the blackened mesquite and the blackened trees and everything where the crash was. She saw it. And they didn't have any toys then because they were poor. So they had these strips of metal that they would crunch up and it would go back to the same. And Jose didn't know that because he wasn't there then. He had gone to California. Yeah. So I've got another witness. And then she's telling me, oh, well, you know, Jose and Remy, they put all this beautiful fiber optics. She didn't call it fiber optics. She called it angel hair. Yeah. It was all lit up and we had no electricity. So she says, we put it on the Christmas trees and we gave it to the people because they saw it in the window. Now, if you don't think that's crazy. So later on, when I'm talking to Sabrina in February of this year, she said, well, you know who trimmed the Christmas tree is Faustino Myers. I said, so he saw the stuff that was strewn all over the crash site. And she said, yes. So Jacques went down with me to Socorro. And Faustino knew nothing about the book. He knew nothing about the crash. He knew nothing about anything. And that's the fourth witness in the revised book. Jacques sits with him and says, were you playing around with these filaments that were all lit up? And Faustino said, yes, we trimmed the Christmas tree. And then he said he would take pieces and put them down people's back because they were irritating. And I thought, he had no idea we did the book. He had no idea about the UFO. This is a man who just lives on a farm. And after 60 years, he and Sabrina connected because he was in the house at the time. So this is how you find witnesses. You have them keep talking and talking and talking. I don't want to find any more, though, Paul. I've had it. This is data. It costs a lot of money to keep going down there, to question, to get the exact words. And that's why the book has exact. It has exact words or what people call transcripts. Because none of this is Jack and mine. We're just putting it together.
One of the things that strikes me about the incident and the first sort of appearance of these creatures that the boys mention is Remy's description of them sliding as though they'd seem to be, he doesn't seem to move, but they seem to go from one place to another, which I find really quite creepy that they seem to be sort of moving through time and space without you sort of realizing it. I've not heard of a witness having an encounter like this, Paula, that they seem to describe it as such a way because it's such a, an evocative word, sliding.
Yeah, but Jose used the word sashaying, which is, I know. What do you mean they were sashaying? You know, sashaying is a dance move. He goes, yeah, he said they were sashaying and they were making high pitched noises like a baby crying or like, what? This is what's so real. Or when you shoot a rabbit.
Yeah.
Now, if this didn't happen, why is he telling me the high pitched sound is when you shoot a rabbit and it's dying? You know, it's, and he wanted to go help him. And then Remy started to cry because he's younger and his eyes were burning because of the fire. And so, because then Jose said, if I'd gone in there, he wouldn't see me today. So I can't guess what these beings were, but there's a possibility they were artificial intelligence clones. You know, in 1945, they were sent by something to make a statement. They were sent by, because all of the, and there's Aztec and Corona, you know, there are other crashes, you know, between 1945, and let's make that a pin. It's real. It happened. They know what happened. We could see the marks on the ground. To 1948, there's all these incidents in New Mexico. And that is the area where a lot of the military were working with these projects. And of course, people say, well, why did they crash? First of all, the thunderstorms and the lightning storms are horrible. It's like nothing you've ever seen. I've been through those and the lightning hits the ground. And I don't think that whatever crashed was counting on interacting with that. But whatever crashed, it was a controlled crash. And the only thing that flew off was a panel of the door. So that whatever was in there was the angel hair and the long strips of metal. And if you read the book, which is really interesting, the boys together only found a little square of it. And Remy told me he put it in his Prince Albert can, a tobacco can, because they were chewing tobacco. And then they fixed the windmill with it. And I thought, oh, my God, we got to go to the windmill. I've got to pull up the windmill and find that piece. But, you know, 60 years had gone by and they had taken the windmill out and there was a swimming pool. And it's, you know, we did all the research on this. You know, there was a swimming pool and it's dead because if we could have pulled out the windmill and gotten the piece.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like detective work, like you can't believe.
It did make me chuckle that when they were talking about that. And you think, well, something was going on there because that windmill, they were saying, and I don't know, I think he says to you, I don't know what you did to it, but it was still working for 60 years.
Yeah. they could seal it because I don't know what that stuff is. I mean, there was some of that in Roswell. I don't know what those long strips. I mean, we can't guess. This is coming from somewhere else. I don't like making a guess. And then the next thing that people say is, did you analyze peace? Well, Jacques has it. It's in Silicon Valley. It's in Stanford. And that piece eventually will be under glass. Let me tell everybody, it's at Rice University, where Jacques Vallée, Wetley Strieber, and I are leaving all our archives. You can see behind me, I'm starting to mail out all of my research to Rice in Houston.
Yeah.
And all the audio from that, all the movies that we took from this case will be Rice, including the piece. So this. We want to leave this for humanity. This isn't our story. This belongs to planet Earth.
Yeah. One of the bits that makes me chuckle as well is obviously word gets around very quickly about what's going on. And the officials turn up, start to cordon off the area and building a road to it, which always makes me chuckle that they had to build a road to get to this crash.
Oh, yeah, right.
But the officer that turns up at the house and says, oh, yeah, we one of our experimental weather balloons has crashed.
Right.
And you're like, I'm sure I've heard this story somewhere else.
Well, they must have had some kind of cover story. The thing is, it's 6 foot. I think you can get a weather balloon through it. But if you go to the location, you can see where they cut more than 30 feet off the gate, you know, more than 30 feet. And of course, in those days, everybody had respect for the military. You know, Faustino Padilla is not going to say, that isn't a weather balloon. I was inside with Sheriff Apodaca, because Faustino and Sheriff Apodaca went inside the craft.
Yeah.
He can't do that. You're not going to do that to military people. So he gave permission because it was 30 feet in diameter, 15 feet tall, an avocado-shaped craft with the dome. So Jacques put the Socorro, New Mexico case of Lonnie Zamora, an avocado-shaped craft Yeah. I just came back from France because I had to see for myself Volensole, an avocado-shaped craft with a dole, came down in a lavender field with two little men who started collecting lavender.
Yes.
And there's, yes, and Morris Mas was going to hit them because they were tiny.
Yeah.
And I talked to the, so a la boots on the ground,
yeah,
went to Volensole to stand in the place where this thing landed, to talk to the townspeople. And all of those guys, Lonnie Zamora and Morris Mas, went through a lot of ridicule, a lot of pain. The kids didn't because they didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I mean, the kids just went on there with their lives. There is no UFO background for those kids. They don't know what they experienced. I mean, there was nothing in 1945. So how could they say later on they figured it out? Because later on was the UFO mythology community and data that came out.
Mm.
But before that, what do you attach it to? I mean, when they were looking at it, and even the government, I think, go, what the heck is this?
Mm.
You know, they're going, we haven't had an avocado thing, you know, before, and what's inside and what was this all about? So you have to look at it historically. You can't look at it in the context of today's information. And Paul, disinformation, there's so much disinformation out there.
Well, you can tell if we are to take this on the evidence given to us by Remy and Jose, the reaction clearly shows an organization that's never dealt with this before, because often when we talk about UFO crash retrievals, the stories are always the same. People in Hamzat suits, big tents, cordoning the area off, all that's going on, spraying chemicals everywhere to neutralize whatever. Here, they all just turn up in their normal clothes because they've no idea what they're dealing with.
No, they don't know. And the guys, the young guys that were on the Manhattan Project were, I mean, I have to laugh when I think about it, because the boys are waiting for them to leave so they can get a souvenir.
Yeah.
And here the guys with the Jeep playing country music, and they really don't want to pick up the pieces. So what they do is they make a little hole with their feet and shove some of the pieces in. And, you know, I know, and it's logical. Now, I was very close to Clifford Stone, very close. In fact, Clifford and I helped publish his book, and he was crash retrieval. So I was able to ask Clifford Stone, he did 12 of them. I said, what did you guys do with some of the bodies? I mean, he did 12 of them. He started in 1969 with the first one in Indian Town Gap, Indiana. So the thing is that I said, they had enough bodies, so they didn't keep all the bodies all the time. They would leave them out, Clifford told me, so that their own would come and pick them up, their own. And I'm going, do you know who their own is? And he goes, no. He said, we just leave them there, and the next day they'd be gone. So everybody says, what happened to the beings? Well, who knows? You know, I don't think they're going to stay there. I mean, but I have no idea. I can't answer any of the questions. Who are they? Where are they from? And everything. And but I do know, and I'll go on record saying this. This is a statement that has to do with they really wanted people to understand what we had started in this nuclear age. You can't put Pandora's box. You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Mm.
It just escalates. We are playing a chess game with nuclear right now, and the only way to win is to checkmate. That means everybody has to get nuclear. Everybody has to, you know, threaten each other with ultimate destruction. And I think those beings were smart enough to say, what were you thinking?
Mm.
You know, when you guys started this thing. And that all gone. And even Jacques anymore, you know, looks at the nuclear issue. Because again, it's not a UFO book. It's a history book.
Mm. I think it is one of the aspects of all this that will often get overlooked as well, is that, I mean, I've seen a lot and read a lot over the years, Paola, that a lot of people do put a lot of faith in the fact that it's the dropping and the creation of the atomic era and the bombs being dropped that essentially signals to whoever is out there, wherever they may be, wherever they come from, that we are preparing to accelerate our development on a scientific level, even. Maybe, obviously, the parameters of the atomic bomb and the destruction it can wreak on our planet, as you mentioned earlier about the destroyer of worlds, clearly atomic bombs have the capacity to cause irreparable damage to any large body out there in the solar system. And if you add two and two together, if these clever humans decide to suddenly start flying into space, which very quickly we did, then all of a sudden, if you're looking at us thinking, oh, look at those people there, they're still mulling about. And then all of a sudden in the 20th century, we go from bicycles to motor cars to building atomic bombs in the space of 50 years. Then all of a sudden, anybody else out there starts to think, hang on here, we might have a problem.
Well, you know, you're very right about that. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. But you know, the thing is also, if you read Colonel Corso's work, he said we had a Project Horizon where we were going to test the bomb on the moon.
Yeah.
Do you want to know how wise that is? I mean, do you know how insane that is?
Yeah.
Whoever's on the moon is going to, they're coming here with the bomb to test. Oh, well, you know, maybe we should not invite them. But again, Paul, people need to read everything. You can't be on internet. You've got to start reading these books. You've got to start reading Timothy Good's, you know, Earth and Alien Enterprise, Colonel Corso's The Day After Roswell, Edgar Mitchell's The Path of the Explorer. I read everything. Otherwise, I couldn't figure this out for beings. I mean, it isn't just our story. Mm. It's the story of the planet. It is piecing together the puzzle. And I'm not surprised that maybe we're not, you know, welcome anywhere. Then my whole life gets crazy because I'm in Italy and I'm interviewing Guy Andronic, who is a geophysicist from France. And he's saying that he was on the island of Fakatofa, the Bikini Atoll, and the French did 800 H-bomb tests. 800. Mm. I was like, they do three? I was like, four? And that there was 3 feet of dead fish on the runway. And there was the coral was dying. And they had flyovers of UFOs. Well, those UFOs didn't bomb them. They didn't kill them. They didn't tell them to stop.
Mm.
But they did watch them. Yeah. And that's the only time my house was broken into in Rome. The film footage was taken. All the computers I was with the policeman doing the filming. Mm. His stuff was taken. Made it look like some kind of, I was on the 7th floor, so they must have jumped it over balconies. And I realized, you know, the atomic bomb, we did H-bomb tests, which is 10 times the atomic bomb.
Mm.
So it's not just the atomic bomb, Paul. It's all of the stuff, killing of the planet, the killing of the trees, the ecology, all of it. It's the all of it it's like warning. Are you people wanting to hang out very long on this planet? Are you people thinking that maybe you're going to live forever here? Because it isn't going to happen. Mm. You can't take care of your planet, and your thoughts of warfare constantly of not coming together is going to cause you problems. So all we can do is fly over. And people say, oh, well, you know, they're a threat. Let's go to the government and get funds so we can shoot at them. you know, please. Yeah. They would have done something in the Bikini Atoll. They would have done something way before now. What they're doing is, and this is, I guess, one of my last statements. You can ask me other questions, but my work from now on is to get out of the nuts and bolts stuff and to start working with raising consciousness. Hmm. We need to wake up. If I can do anything with all the work I've done, with all the real data, to raise consciousness, that's where I want to be. And that's why I'm working mainly in Latin America. Mm. I'm working in Colombia, Chile. I'll be in Chile in January, in Argentina. And I've done a lot of work in Peru. And the real answers to the contact is there, because those people are just regular people. That's, to them, it's normal to see UFO or interact with beings. And so my work from now on, I'm shifting over to consciousness raising work based on real data.
Mm. Do you think it's surprising, touching on that point you raised there, Paola, that obviously in the 1950s, a lot of people who became obsessed or indoctrinated into UFOs and ufology at that point, a lot of them were spreading this message of universal peace and love and harmony and coming together and raising their spirituality and becoming more attuned to the world around them, and that we couldn't carry on in the way that we were, which is why the FBI and the CIA took a great deal of interest in a lot of contactees at that period, because in their opinion, they were communists trying to dissuade people from the atomic age and believing everything the American government was saying. So for me, I find it quite interesting that there seems to be this groundswell in the modern era of people once again kind of returning to this spiritual-based understanding of the world around us and knowing that we are at the precipice of a fundamental change if we're not already on that cusp of going too far. And whatever happens after this, we're never going to be able to save it.
I love that you touch on this, Paul, because that's what I did. I went back to the future. I went back to the giant rock days. I went back to Adamski. By the way, thanks to Michel Zerger, who was a French researcher, we have a photo of Warthorn because it was enlarged by René Olsen in the Netherlands. So we know Warthorn landed in 1952 at Desert Center. We have his footprints, thanks to George Hunt Williamson. The message was the same. And Warthorn said, you either stop this or you're going down the path of destruction. And then Adamski goes all over the world, gives lectures, and the ETs are with him. Some of those people were with him. And the thing is, we had Eugenio Siracusa on the island of Sicily with the very same message, with the very same people in the 1950s. The Jaya Rock group, and I could do a whole lecture on this because I went and brought them all back to Jaya Rock in 2014. Mm. And the last of the Jaya Rock group was a guy named Robert Short who said, when we had contact with these spacemen walking, and there were no grays until 1960s. Mm. So, when that happened, then you could put the whole world under fear and all we have is gray aliens all over internet. Mm. But in those days, the Robert Short told me they were talking to him on crystal radio. I said, you're kidding. He goes, there was a frequency. He said we could talk to the beings that we had just met. And he said the FBI came and shut that down. And then I did the Amicizia case in Italy. And the same thing, they were talking to them on crystal radio because you can make your own radio with crystal radio. And I began connecting the dots. And I said, oh, my God, these guys came from these other places and they were people, which is very threatening to the U.S. or anybody else, because Colonel Corso said, I'm not worried about the beings, the clones and the EBs and whatever. He said, I'm worried about the people that created them, because they could be walking in the halls of the Pentagon. That's what he said to me personally. Mm. And so in the 50s, we had this group of contactees, Menger, Adamski, Orfeo Angelucci, Van Tassel, who were telling the truth about contact. And it was this message. But since the powers that be, and it's not the U.S. government, it's probably the military-industrial complex, are interested mostly in the craft and the technology, these beings stopped coming here. Guess where they went? They went to Peru. They went to Latin America and started walking off ships. Hmm. Why would they come here? They're still, the New York Times is interested in the Tic Tac. They're not interested in what's inside or who it is. But we're looking at Tic Tacs. We're looking at, craft. We're looking at pieces. We're looking at metal. And nobody is asking the right questions. And so that's why I want to work in Latin America. But I did all of that. And ironically enough, when I bought Robert Short back to do a channeling, because the being said, since we can't use that frequency, could we use your throat? In other words, we will talk. The voice that came out of him was not Robert Short's voice. But in 2014, the channeling that was done at Giant Rock mentioned Vladimir Putin. And I was saying, well, that's crazy. He's not even in the news. And the channeling word for word is what's happening today. Mm-hmm. And I had to, this is 2014, so do the math. Mm-hmm. They knew through the throat of Short. And by the way, that's on my YouTube channel if people want to see the work I did with Giant Rock. Through Robert Short, who was deceased, he and his wife were some of the only survivors of that group in the 50s. Mm-hmm. They had met everybody. So have I done my homework? Yeah. Did I figure it out? Yeah. That we were warned and whoever is coming here just gave up and went down to Latin America. And then we're stuck with the abduction, which I hate the word, the contact scenario. And it seems to me that it's ridiculous that 40 years, you can't get enough genetic material and you have to keep coming back. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's very, whoever's doing it. I think that we're stuck in ufology in a certain lane. We're never going to get out of it. it's either the craft, the technology, or, you know, negative contact. I believe, and I will say this, that this planet and its inhabitants are the real problem. And I want to work to raise the consciousness. And I was very close to John Mack, very, very close. And his last words to me were, Paula, we have to accommodate our worldview to this reality, not them. And he said, we are the virus of the universe. And he was in my apartment in Rome, and I was his translator in Florence. So, you know, I got to talk to the greats at Colonel Corse, Edgar Mitchell, who did not believe we were ready for contact. So many of these people. And so I'm just encouraging people to read this case, which is mind-blowing because we have the details, that it's a warning and that Jacques and I tried to do the best we could.
I've always been very struck, especially in Chile, Paula, that they seem very open-minded about this particular subject. There's no, the government aren't hiding anything. They're very forthcoming. They're very open. They talk about sightings. They talk about radar responses and records that they've got. The pilots will talk about their own encounters. Do you find that it seems that the old allies, us, the US, Canada, France, they're all sort of still working on this old sort of Cold War veil of secrecy, whereas the sort of newer countries that have risen free from those shackles or were perhaps involved in the conflict as much during the Second World War, places like Chile, have a more open and honest opinion about this particular subject?
First of all, not only Chile, but I also encourage people in my Laughlin conference, we're going to be screening James Fox's movie on Virginia. Mm-hmm. And there was depression. You have to understand, if you're looking at this, that the Americans are the first one to come take everything, whether it's Latin America or Europe or anywhere.
Yeah.
So if they're the ones that are coming and taking the craft and taking the stuff and everything, it has to do with materials and it has to do with military industrial complex. And Chile doesn't have a military industrial complex, it's back engineering, anything. They basically are trying to figure out history, you know, because the visitations of planet Earth start with the Mayans.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the Aztecs, the Egyptians, and every other ancient cultures. It isn't like one day they all discover planet Earth. Mm-hmm. It's you have to study ancient cultures to do that. And Chile is open because Chile has nothing to lose. I mean, they're making anything. They don't, you know, where the military industrial complex is, who's taken over, the government doesn't know anything. The president doesn't know anything. It's the military industrial complex. You study what Richard Dolan says and the people that have done the work on that. It's about money. I mean, it's about back engineering. It's about who gets the most toys. It's about the technology. It's about war technology. And so if it's all about that, and it's not about who's inside, I mean, have you heard anybody even mention in the Tic Tac stuff in the New York Times, maybe we should look at who's piloting these things? No, that they wouldn't dare say anything like that because they shut it down right away. Mm. So as long as it stays on the technology and on science and on that, it's harmless. It's not going to change anything.
Mm.
It won't change anything. I do think that if we have a nuclear situation, there will be an intervention.
Mm.
But I don't want to get there. I don't want that.
No. Oh, I agree.
Why don't we do that? You know, it's like, but you asked about Chile. They have no stake in not telling, you know, but anything that happens there, there's Americans involved. I interviewed people on the Chile friendship case, the guys that were involved with the ETs, and the ETs came to their house. They were people. So 90% of all ETs are really ETs are people.
Mm.
And it gets confusing because they may be sitting in your restaurant. Even Timothy Good says that he met one in New York, that he said to the being who had a three-piece suit on, was reading a newspaper, if you're not from here, take your index finger and put it on the left side of your nose. And the guy did that. And poor Timothy's sitting there going, well, what do I do? You know, it's so that opens up a lot of questions as to if they're here because they're people.
Yeah.
And I want to get into more of that because it interests me. But going back to Trinity, history interests me also.
Mm. Absolutely. And it should be. I think it's one of those things that often people for some reason, Paolo, in whatever kind of field, a lot of people tend to have a line in the sand. And if anything's occurred before that, or anybody's written anything before that, or anybody's done any research or investigation, if it's, say, for example, before 1980, oh, well, that's old fashioned. It's old hat. We don't need to bother looking at that. And I, as someone that loves history as well, I'm always infuriated by things like that, because it will often give you a template and a bigger palette of resource to be able to come to a more knowledgeable answer to the questions that you found.
Yes, and Paul, I want to thank you, because you asked me like questions that really, you know, are worthwhile. They're not commercial questions. They're questions of you and I thinking about the history of this planet and the history of humanity and how this all came about. And I enjoyed this kind of dialogue, but unfortunately with my old colleagues, we never have it because nobody has gone backwards and looked at a giant rock. Nobody has gone backwards and looked at what happened before. You know, I don't know where they start. They start maybe from Roswell, but 1952, we had a flyover of the Capitol. I mean, that was, that was a wake up call if nothing was. And then Robert Wise puts out the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And Robert Short is telling me that was a government disclosure movie and that they knew about it. They even have some real footage. And I'm going, okay, well, why aren't people looking at the whole picture and putting together the pieces of the puzzle?
Mm. It happens here in the UK. It's not just the US, Paolo. It happens here in the UK. Most people, if you find somebody that's interested in UFOs, they'll probably have heard of a handful of cases. They will not think of anything else that's happened in the UK, probably before Rendlesham. They'll not consider it. They'll think it's, oh, well, that's when it started, just after Close Encounters came out. So therefore, they try and tie an explanation to it. Whereas some of Britain's best cases happened in the 1970s. We've got the fabulous case from Wales at the school, which was seen by dozens of children. And that was written off as a council recycling van. So, you know, so it's always been there, Paola, but some people just don't want to look at the information's there. Some people just don't want to look at it.
Well, I'm very close to Steve LaPlume, who was, you know, Rendlesham. He had his own sighting. It changed his life. It was shocking for him. And he's written a book called From a Rendlesham to Redemption. I helped him publish that book. I helped Clifford Stone publish his book. I helped Ricardo Gonzalez published his book because I'm a book person. And Steve said that because, you know, I mean, it came out that the light was shown over his weapon storage area. I mean, these things are not on vacation. There's a reason for it. And you got to look at the Cold War. You have to look at the dates. You have to look at what's around there. And so Rendlesham for me was very important. I've also talked to Peniston about this. Actually, I helped him also do his book, because people don't do this, if they make this an academic subject, can you imagine if you went to college and you never read a book on anthropology and you were studying it, or you read one book on anthropology and you got a degree? I was going, you people, you have to read source material, read all of Hynek, read the Blue Book stuff, read, you know, the early days, read, oh, Howard Menzies, From Outer Space to You. I just finished going back to New Jersey and looking at where he was and what those landings were at. And the Historical Society of New Jersey is talking about this. And none of my colleagues have been there. And I'm going, these things were landing. And there's movies and there's photos of Howard with his arms around the Venusians in his orchard. And I'm going, but, you know, we don't want to go there because it's mostly abductions and, you know, contact and all that kind of stuff. And I'm saying, no, it didn't start like that. So I love the fact that your questions are really good about history. I encourage people to start reading again, to get a library or start a reading group, or reading, what do you call it? Let's do 1 week, one day, 1 month, day a month of a reading group on, and let's share our ideas. Because I'm convinced, Paul, if we do that, they know we're doing that. I mean, they go, the humans are interested.
Yeah.
The humans are interested. The humans are trying to put together the puzzle.
Yeah. Well, I could keep picking your brains and throwing questions at you like that, Paola, but I know you're a very busy lady. So I know you've touched on it earlier on, conferencing. You're still arranging your regular conference.
Yes. Well,
tell me a little bit about that, please.
Well, you know, I'm trying to bring this information as an educator to the outside world. My conference is different. You'll see our red carpet be the Webb telescope. You won't see little gray alien statues or people wearing all that. Because I figure if there's any scientists walking by, I want them in there, and they're not going to walk in there if they see that stuff. So what I've had over the years is Uri Geller talking to Russell Targ about his being examined at Stanford. I've had people talking about quantum physics and how you can explain, you know, telepathy. I've had Jacques Vallée talking about artificial intelligence. This year, I have Regina Meredith talking about the new human. I have somebody who does incredible remote viewing work. I have the paranormal involved too in Andrea Perone, and just incredible people that will talk about all of it. And it's not just about UFOs. So it's in Laughlin, Nevada, 1 hour from Las Vegas. It's 11/11, which, you know, everybody remembers to 11/13. And my company that will put out these videos, and by the way, Jaime Maussan's videos from Mexico are incredible. He showed us the UFOs coming in and out of volcanoes last year. Everybody gave him standing ovation. 2 hours of film footage. Mm-hmm. And my company is www.starworksusa.com. Starworks USA. We're not doing any streaming or anything, but the videos will be of this talk will be available online. And then this is the last one I'm doing. People, you know, with what's happening with the economy, they're just not coming together anymore. So this will be the last Laughlin conference. So I wanted to tell you about that. I've made an effort to switch gears. I mean, I had all the giant rock people. I talked about that. I talked about Virginia. I talked about Southern. It's around Ricardo Gonzalez, who is from Peru. So we're showing James Fox's film, Virginia, plus our trip to Peru there. And it's the last one, www.starworksusa.com.
So, Paola, thank you for your time today. Where can everybody follow your work and get hold of a copy of the book we've talked about today, Trinity, and anything else that they may want to track you down that you've been involved in?
Well, Trinity's on Amazon in 4 different languages and also will be in Japanese. And for me, Paola, I'm ItalianHarris.com, talks about my personal work and what I've done and where I'm going from here. And I think my email is on there. Thank you so much for having this dialogue with me. It's been a lot of fun.
I'll put my links into the show notes as I do every week for everybody, Paola.
All right.
So thank you again for your time today. It's been a real
pleasure. All right. Thanks.